All right, we're getting with the Mishnah on the top of Nun Bet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah begins, Mitzvat HaNisrafim. So as in the previous parak, we dealt with Mitzvat HaNiskalim. We dealt with how stoning is done, or the execution of stoning is done. Here, the Mishnah discusses how the punishment of Srefa is done. Clearly, the Mishnayot are following the position of the Chachamim, which by Skila is the most Chamor, and now we moved on to Srefa. Mitzvah and Yisrafim, are you mishakim oto b'zevel ad arkubotav? They used to bury him in zevel up to his knees. So Rashi over here claims that the reason we do that is because we don't want him moving around. We don't want him to make it difficult for us to carry out the remainder of the procedure. So they bury him in zevel up to his knees. The problem with that explanation is that the next Mishnah says the same thing by Chenek. Although you could argue that by Chenek as well, we don't want him causing us problems by moving around so much. On the other hand, the Yad Ramah suggests that the reason that we bear him as Zevel at Arkavotav is because many times people in these positions where they're very feeble, they're close to death, they lose control over their bodily functions, and then they might defecate or embarrass themselves. So if we bury them up to Arkavotav and Zevel, then that will mitigate the embarrassment or the issue of them possibly defecating on themselves because they're already in Zevel, they're already buried up to a certain level, and that might prevent that type of embarrassment. That's what the Yad Ramah suggests. So that's why we would bury him in not sand or earth, but rather in Zevel, both because of what Rashi says we're trying to prevent the movement, but also what the Yad Ramah says is that we're trying to make it so that it offsets, mitigates the problem of him possibly losing control of his bodily functions. Nodim sudar kasher letoch haraka. So again, similar to what we've seen before, you put this harder material inside of this softer material. V'korech al tzavero. And then they put it around his neck. Zemoch shechetzlo, v'zemoch shechetzlo. Each pull on one side, here probably the edim. Adje boteach et piv, until it forces his mouth to open. Umadlik et aptila, and then they light whatever this ptila is. It's usually a wick, but we'll see. Zorka letoch piv, then they throw it down his throat. V'yoreda letoch me'av, goes down into his innards. V'chumeret et b'nei me'av, and then it burns up. It consumes his intestines and his innards. So that is the sreifa. Rav Yehuda Omer, afu imet bi'adam lo yumikaimim bo mitzvat sreifa. So Rashi over here claims that the afhu is lishna ba'almahu. It's extraneous language that is not necessary here. It's just a manner of expression. Now then, the Rashash claims that the afhu is Rabbi Yehuda's statement connecting it to the next Mishnah, which says that this is the method for chenek. And he's saying afhu, that if you do that, then he's going to end up similar to the one who is getting chenek. V'imeit bi'adam. And therefore, if he dies over here, they're not mikayim the mitzvah of sreifa, but rather the mitzvah of chenek. And so that's the issue, which is afhu is beginning punished with chenek and not with sreifa. That's the way the Rashash learns it. The Yad Ramah connects this with Rabbi Yehuda's position that you want to use a soft cloth on the inside so that he doesn't choke. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with that fundamentally and says that will choke him. And I can prove it to you because the Mishnah further on says that chenek is done in that way. And so then, afhu, even the softer cloth is going to cause strangulation. And that's not what you're after over here. So if he dies from the strangulation before they get the wick into him, then he's dying of chenek, which is strangulation, and not because of sreifa. And so we haven't been mikayim the mitzvah of sreifa. Ella, if you would suggest, poteach et piv, mitzvat, he opens up the mouth with tongs, shelo b'tovato, whether he likes it or not, meaning if he's unwilling to open it, we force open his mouth. Umadlik et aptila, and then they light the wick, v'zorka letoch piv, and then they throw it down his throat, v'reda letoch me'av, and goes into his innards, v'chumeret b'nei me'av, and then it consumes his intestines. Rashi says, she'ikav tzu, which means that they will shrink or shrivel up, and the Aruch says, chamar maru means to get heated up or boiled up. Amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok, maseh b'bat kohen achat, shezinta. We have an incident that took place with the bat kohen who had znut, which makes her subject to the punishment of sreifa. B'kifua chabilei zmurot. And they piled around her bundles of kindling, b'sarfua. And they burnt her at the stake. Amru lo mipnei shelo haya beitin shelo tosha baki. That's because the beitin then didn't know what they were doing. And so they burnt her at the stake. Rashi claims over here that they were a Beit Din Shel Tzdukim, who take the psukim literally, and therefore they said Sreifa means literally to be burnt, burnt at the stake, as opposed to the Drashat Chazal, which we're going to see in a second, which indicates that that's not the way to accomplish Sreifa. And he says you can't bring evidence from that incident, because that incident was the exception to the rule, because it was done by people who didn't know what they were doing. Okay, my ptila. So what is this wick that we are speaking about over here? Amar Rav Matna ptila shel avar. It is a wick of lead, or in essence, it's lead that is heated up. You take a long strip of lead, you heat it up till it's molten lead, and then you pour it down the individual's throat, and it does what the Mishnah indicates. Minalan, how do we know that that's the mechanism or the method by which you do sreifa? Acha sreifa, sreifa miadat korach. We learn out a gzeirah shava of sreifa from the incident by Korach. By Korach, you have the rebellion that involves Korach and challenging Moshe. You also have the rebellion that's challenging the leadership of Aaron. And in that challenge, they have the 250 men, the Makrivei Ktoret, who bring the Ktoret to see whose Ktoret is accepted. And in the process of bringing the Ktoret of Aaron is accepted. The Ktoret of the other men, when they bring their pans, are burnt up, and they're consumed by fire. Malalan Srefat Nishama Viguf Kayam, just like by Atat Korach, the fire consumed them, but not their bodies. Afkan Srefat Nishama Viguf Kayam, so too over here, causing Srefa that has internal impact, but leaves the body intact. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Acha Srefa, Srefa Mibne Aron. By Zereshava, instead of Zereshava leading to Adat Korach, leads to Nadab and Avihu, who die by an Ish also. Malan Sreifa Neshama V'Guf Kayam. Just like over there by Nadab and Avihu, their innards, their Neshama was burnt up, their life was lost from the fire, but their bodies were intact. Avkan Sreifa Neshama V'Guf Kayam. So too, over here, the Sreifa has to affect the individual internally, but leave the body intact. Mandi Yolik Miadat Korach Minale. So in the one who learns out from Adat Korach, how does he know that by Adat Korach, the consumption by the fire was not complete, but rather just the innards or the neshama of the individuals? Dichtiv. Machtot Echadim Aile Benafshotam. So it says that the machtot, the pans of those that sinned Benafshotam. So over there, Aaron makes it into a cover for the Mizbeach, because the machtot were nitkadesh when they were brought by these individuals. But it says, b'nafshotam, shenishmatam nisrefet v'guf kayam. So learn from the word nafshotam, because they sinned with their nefesh, then mida keneged mida, their nafshotam was the thing that was consumed or burnt out. Vidach, ha'yisrefa mamash. On the other hand, the other party that learns it out from the Nav Avihu says over here, it's really srefa. Umay b'nafshotam. So what does it mean, nafshotam? Shenitchaybu srefa liskenish nafshotam. The reason they were subject to this punishment of Srifa is because they did something with their nefesh. They sinned with their nefesh that caused them to be worthy of such a punishment. Kidei Reish Lakish, Damar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish explains, Mai Dechtiv, what is meant by the Pasuk in Tehillim. B'chanfei la'agei ma'og charok alai shinemo. So the translation of the Pasuk is, with mockery and flattery, because of a loaf, for the sake of a loaf, they gnashed their teeth at me. Bishvil chanufa shechnifu leKorach, because of the flattery, or because of what they engaged with Korach, aliskei legima, because of the food and the items that he gave them. Charak aleim sarshel geinom shinav, the minister of Geinom gnashed his teeth or sharpened his teeth for them. So here Rashi explains to us that because of the food and drink that Korach gave to them, and they joined him, meaning that they were captured by the wealth of Korach, the fact that he invited them to the feast, he fed them, he gave them to drink, and that brought them into the rebellion. So because of their flattery or their willingness to join the meal and accept these goodies from Korach, that led them down a path of joining that of Korach, and then they were subject to the punishment of this pasuk, that they who looked up to Korach and joined Korach to get the benefits of being a part of Korach, they end up with this type of fate. Or the possibility is that these people were chateim b'nafshotam. They sinned for the enjoyments of life. Food and drink were the things that they were after, they were lahut after, that they ran after. And Gehinom is ready for people like that. Gehinom is for people who do not control their desires, do not control their ta'avot. And since they didn't control their ta'avot, the result in punishment was that they were subject to the punishment of Gehinom, like is noted in the pasuk over here. That because of a ma'og, for a loaf and for food, the individual ends up in the teeth or the claws of someone who wants their death, and that is the Sarshel Gehinom. And as the Maharal points out, just like someone who searches after the pleasures and materialistic side of this world is never satisfied, so too Gehinom is never satisfied, and therefore it's the proper Midah Keneged Midah. And then the Maharal says that someone who's involved in Kina and Kavod, the Psukim tell us that he will rot, and therefore he's appropriately found in Gehinom. So Mandi Ali Bnei Aron, the one who learns it out Bnei Aron, Adav and Avihu, Benale, where does he know that it's Sreifa of the inside and not the body? Tichtei Vayamutu Lifnei Hashem, they died before Hashem, Ke'ein Mita, like a death. And so the assumption is that they died without being consumed. Vidoch, how Sreifa Mamash Avai? The other party learns it out of that Korach will say, no, they were burnt up, consumed completely. Umay dichtiv ve'yamutu, that they died. The atchil behu migavai, that it started internally to ein mita, similar to death. So ve'yamutu is something where a person dies naturally. Over here, they didn't die naturally. They were killed by the fire that came out from Hashem. So now what the person who learns out from Nadav Avihu says is, that's exactly what happened here. They looked like they died naturally, but the cause of death was really the fire that consumed them internally. On the other hand, the other party says they were actually consumed by fire. They were completely burnt. But then why does it say Be'amutu? Meaning that the way that they were consumed, the way that they were killed, was through internally that expanded then to externally. So the fire started internally, but then it consumed them even externally, and they were completely burnt. Titania. Abi Yossi ben Dustai Omer, Shnei Chutim Shel Eish Yatzu Mibeit Kodesh HaKodeshim, two beams of fire came out from the Kodesh HaKodeshim, V'nechlukul Arba, and then they split into four, V'nechnesu Shnayim B'chot Moshel Zeh, or Shnayim B'chot Moshel Zeh, V'sarfum, and two of them entered each of their nostrils, and it consumed them in fire. That's the Nadav ben Avihu, making it sound like it was an internal burning. Again, both opinions agree that there was an internal burning. Question is, did that then continue with consuming the entirety of their bodies? Or that it just consumed them internally, but their bodies remained intact. V'aktiv, v'tochalutam. Doesn't it say v'tochalutam? So now Rashi claims over here that the question here is, demashma miut otam v'lo davar acher. It sounds like they were consumed, but not something else. And now you have to have, what is the miut? What is left over if they were consumed? So according to the opinion that they were consumed internally, tochalotam means internally they were consumed, but their external, their body was left intact. According to the one who says that their bodies were consumed, what does it mean, tochalotam? They were consumed. What did it leave behind if they were consumed? So what is the miut here? That's the way Rashi reads the question. And it says, otam velo bigdehem. The answer is that it consumed them, but it left their clothing intact. That would be the answer to why the miut is here, to teach you that even though their bodies were consumed, their clothing remained intact. And that's how you answer the question. Others, like the Yad Ramah, suggest that the question's on both opinions, because both opinions seem to indicate that there was the fire killed them either internally or it killed them starting internally and then consumed the rest. Over here in the pasuk, it sounds like v'tocholutam, that it consumed them, that the fire itself consumed them. So it sounds like there was an external consumption. The answer of the Gemara is v'tocholutam is not coming to teach you about how the fire went about, but v'tocholutam v'lo bigdehem. It consumed them and not their clothing. So in that way, it's answering the question as to why does it say v'tocholutam. It's not coming to teach you how the fire consumed them, but rather that the fire only affected them and not their bigadim. The Bali Tosafot over here say, Otam lo bigdehem, bim tomar. Why don't you say, Vakti vaisa'um bekutun otam, that they were carried out in their clothing? So now, there, number one, it's clear that ketun otam, that their bigadim were still there, so I need a pasuk to teach us that. And maybe even the fact that they carried them out in the ketun otam already is indicative of the fact that not only were their bigadim there, but also their bodies were there. Ve'esh lomar, do yadina im bekutanot anosim, o bekutanot anisaim. The word ketun otam there is a dangling modifier. It's not clear when it says that in their clothing, is their clothing referring to the meitim? Was their clothing referring to the ones carrying out the meitim? So does that mean they carried them out while they were wearing their cloaks? Or does that mean that they carried out those that were wearing the cloaks? So it could be referencing to either. So it's unclear there whether the ketun otam refers to Nadav and Avihu or Mishael and Safan who took them out of the Kodesh HaKodeshim. So Tosfot says you can't prove anything from there, and that's why we need here otam velo bigdehem. So Tosfot asks your question over here, and he says, Vim tomar, that we have the Midrash halacha that seems to indicate that Mishael and Safan were tmeim. And that's why they had to wait till Pesach Sheni, and the whole parshia of Pesach Sheni that came about was because they were tmeim from taking care of the bodies of Nadav v'Avihu. So then, if that's the case, then it's clear that something was left, that their bodies were there, and that they became tamei because the bodies existed. So Tosfot brings down, first of all, that there are two midrashim, and michloket midrashim with regards to whether they were consumed entirely or they were just consumed internally. But then he says, if you think they were consumed entirely, what do you do with the midrash that says that they became tamei? So he answers what you just mentioned over here, shildan kayemet. That their skeletons were still there. According to everybody, the skeleton remained intact. So the only question is, was the burning internally, and it left the entire body intact? Or was it that the went internally, expanded externally, consumed their body, but it still left their skeleton intact, and that's what they were carrying out? And then you could even answer the other question, Tosafot Bikutun Otam, means that they were taken out in their clothing, might have been the skeleton in the clothing. So that might answer part of that question as well. But Tosafot indicates that it wasn't that they were consumed and there was nothing left of them at all. And obviously, that has to be reconciled with when Nadav and Avihu died, according to most Rishonim, Farshei HaMikra, it was on the 8th day, which was Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The Ebenezer has a position that it was actually the 8th day of Nisan, and that makes it more plausible that Mishael and Safan were still Tmeim when it came to Pesach and needed a Pesach Sheni. Otherwise, if it happened on Rosh Chodesh, it seems like they had plenty of time to get Tahor in time for Pesach, although you could come up with other reasons as to why they were not successful at doing that. Now the Gemara continues and says, "V'nei lef mi parim and isserfim." Why don't we learn it out from the parim and isserfim, which is, here you had two options, Nadav Avihu and Adat Korach. In both of those options, we spoke about an internal sreifa, leaving the body intact. In other words, if you look at parim nisrafim, which are the parim that are brought into the Kodesh, or the Kodesh HaKodeshim, those carcasses are burnt outside the city of Yerushalayim, but when they're burnt, they're clearly burnt in their entirety. Malan sreifa mamash, just like over there, it's complete consumption by fire. Avkan sreifa mamash. Why don't we use that as the paradigm for Sreifa, rather than using Adat Korach or Nadav Avihu? It says, Mistavrami Adam Havilei Lemelech. Makes more sense to learn out from other people, Adat Korach or Nadav Avihu, Shekein. Because they have these commonalities between them. Adam, we're speaking about people rather than animal carcasses. Choteh, we're speaking about people who sinned. Nadav Avihu, the Adat Korach, or this person is being executed. Nishama, which is that we are trying to take the life of individuals, whether it's the Adat Korach and Nadav Avihu, or in our case, the person's going to be executed, we want them killed, whereas the Parim Nisrafim are already dead. We're just taking the carcasses out to burn. And Pigol, by the case of the human beings, there's no issue of Pigol, it's not Kodoshim. On the other hand, the Parim Nisrafim are subject to Pigol because they are Kodoshim. So you have these four common denominators between them. Adarab, mi parim and isafim, avalei lemelech. We should learn now from parim and isafim. Shekein, because they have these commonalities between them and the execution individual. Machshir, it's part of a process, lidorot, and it's something that exists forever. meaning that the Adad Korach and Adad Avihu were specific events in history. They weren't something that persists over time. The other hand, the Parim Nisrafim, as well as the executions of Beit Din, are both halachot that have application beyond the moment, because they are part of the Avodah and the Mikdash, as well as part of the job description of what the Beit Din does in terms of executions. And also they are a makshir, they're part of a process. They're doing a mitzvah that Hashem says. By Parim Nisrafim and the Beit Din, they're carrying out a mitzvah or protocol that God laid out. On the other hand, by the cases of Adad Korach and Nadav Avihu, there was no human involvement in that. It was simply that God punished them, but no human being was involved in that process as well. And now the Gemara says, Hanach Nefishan. The other one is greater. I mean, we have four common denominators between whether it's Adad Korach, Nadav, and Avihu, and the execution, versus the Parim and the Supreme, where we only have two common denominators. So then the four will trump the two and say that it's more alike to Adad Korach and Nadav and Avihu, and therefore we'll learn from them the method by which we want to do Sreifa over here. Tosvot asks, why don't they just say, Bahafta l'reacha kamocha? We're going to see later on in the Gemara that when you have a choice between two death penalties, you always pick the lighter form or the lighter way to execute the death penalty because of the requirement of Bahafta l'reacha kamocha. So over here too, the Sreifa that is done by Sreifat Neshama is a lot less painful and difficult than being burnt at the stake. So why doesn't that govern over here, Bahafta l'reacha kamocha? So that those who want to suggest that you only apply Bahafta l'reacha kamocha when you have two options that are equally plausible, and we have to decide which one we're going to do. Over here, we have a full-fledged limud from Parim and Nisrafim. Over there, you can't say Bahafta l'reacha kamocha, because the limud teaches you this is sreifa. You can't say don't listen to the Torah sreifa over here because of Bahafta l'reacha kamocha. That assumes that there are options over here that are of equal nature. If you have options that are of equal nature, then you can impose Bahafta l'reacha kamocha. But if you have a limud that says we must learn from here, that limud will dictate what the process is, irrespective of whether it is the best or not best way to do it. So there you can't invoke a Bahafta l'reacha kamocha. Because as the Aruch Linaris points out, that you have both Parim and Nisrafim saying it's real sreifa, and then if you think that the source is Nadav and Avihu for the internal sreifa, then Adad Korach also indicates a full-fledged sreifa, or vice versa. If you think Adad Korach teaches you about the internal sreifa, then Nadav and Avihu and the Parim and Nisrafim teach you about full-fledged sreifa. So you actually have two sources saying that it's a full-fledged sreifa, and only one opposing that. So a Bahafta l'reacha kamocha is not going to govern in that situation, but rather you're going to have to then find a reason why the drusha, the Parim Nisrafim, is not as good or not as good at correlation. Once you've then even the playing field out, then we can invoke the principle of Bahafta l'reacha kamocha. The Gemara goes then on to show how the limudim are not equal. That actually favors the limud of Nadav and Avihu and Adad Korach versus the limud of Parim Nisrafim. And that's why we execute the sreifa in that manner. But not because of Bahafta l'reacha kamocha, which will come up in 1 second. Now Gemara says, Mandi yolif mi Adad Korach, the one who learns it out of Adad Korach, ma'itam lo yolif mi Aharon. Why does he learn from Bnei Aharon? So he explained to us why he thinks the sreifa by Nadav and Avihu was the consumption of their entire body versus the case of Adad Korach. But then you have a choice now. The limud is telling you either learn from Korach or learn from Nadav and Avihu. How did he know to pick Adad Korach? And same thing with the vice versa. So he says, Alo sreifa mamash ave. So that because he believes that it's full-fledged sreifa, b'nei lef minah. And then why not learn from it? So Amar Rav Nachum and Amar Ravu, Amar Kra, this is what we saw earlier in the Masechta, and we're going to see it a number of times today, which is, v'hafta l'reacha kamocha, bror lo mita yafa. Got to pick the nicest way, the most humane way to kill the individual. So I have a choice. The limud could either go to Adad Korach, which is internal sreifa, or it could go to Nadav and Avihu, which is complete consumption by fire. Which one would be the better option in terms of being humane towards the person we're killing? It's clear that internal sreifa is much more gentle than being burnt at the stake. And vice versa would be the same thing. The one who learns from Nadav and Avihu and says that Adad Korach is going to be a real sreifa, so then how does he decide between these two, which is the better way to go? The answer is, which is the more humane way? Bahafta l'reacha kamocha. And as Tosafot already mentioned earlier in the Masechta, that when we invoke this principle of Bahafta l'reacha kamocha, it has specific association with death, and that is because one person during your lifetime, we have the principle of Rabbi Akiva, which is Chayecha Kodmim. That whenever it comes to between a choice between you and another individual, your life takes precedence. Or you take precedence. So you can never be V'achal Recha Kamocha, exactly like you. The only place where you can really invoke it is in death, where you would treat the person exactly like the way you want to be treated, because there's no concept of Chayecha Kodmim there. And so absence Chayecha Kodmim, that's the place where V'achal Recha Kamocha really comes to, into full force. And that's why we invoke it over here. So now, this is your question, which is, if there's a more humane way to do it, then why bother with the Gzeres Shava? If I have to decide between straight for this way, straight for that way, and I say V'Ahavta Recha Kamocha means do it this way and not that way, why do I need Gzeres Shava to teach me that? Ilav Gzeres Shava, if it were not for the Gzeres Shava, Hava Amina Srefat Neshama V'Guf Kayam, Lav Srefahi Klal. I would have thought, in consuming the internals of the individual through fire, burning it, and leaving their body intact is not classified as Srefa. How do you know that that is classified as Srefa? That's what the Gzeres Shava tells us. That's classified as Srefa. Once you've classified it as a Srefa, then you can invoke the principle of Ahavta Recha Kamocha, because then it accomplishes the execution of Srefa. V'yim Mishum Ahavta Recha Kamocha, if you think that Ahavta Recha Kamocha still has to be invoked in that case of Srefa, but we say internal Srefa is not Srefa, then what do? Lafish Lechaviles Murot. Add to the pyre. Just add more wood and more fuel to the fire so that it's super hot and it consumes the individual quickly or more quickly to reduce the pain that is involved. Okay, that he will burn quickly. It's a good place just to note the word la'agal. La'agal means quickly or hurriedly. And that's what we say in Kaddish, ba'agala ubizman kariv. Ba'agala means speedily or hurriedly. The Zman Kariv, in the near term. And that's what we're asking Hashem, to bring about His revelation, the redemption, in a hurried or quick manner, that He should reveal Himself. So this is the word Lagil over here. It's the Aramaic that's used in Kaddish. So Kamash Malan, that the Gzeres Shava teaches us that the Srefa, or internal Srefa, is classified as Srefa. Once you do that, Ahavta Recha Kamocha will augur for us picking that over a regular Srefa being burnt at the stake. So now the Gemara gets pulled to a segue over here. It seems that the connection, of course, is Nadav v'Avihu, but there are those like the Marsha want to take it a step further and say that it has to connect to him with Chotim b'Nafshotam, that they sinned with their Nefshot. And what does it mean, Chotim b'Nafshotam? Kvarayu Moshe v'Aron malchim b'derech. They were walking along, v'Nadav v'Avihu malchim achareihem. And Nadav and Avihu were walking behind them, v'Chol Yisrael achareihem, and then the rest of Klal Yisrael behind them. Amalo Nadav Laviyu, so Nadav whispers Naviyu, Ematay Yamutu Shnei Zekeinim Alalo, when they were the two older ones, I mean Moshe Aaron pass away, Vani Vata Nagig at the door, and then we'll become the leaders of the generation. They were the leaders in waiting. So whenever you have a leader in waiting, the question is, when will they get the chance to lead? Well, the only obstacle between them and leadership is the previous leader, or the leaders that are in power right now. So many times in monarchies and other places, the individuals knock off the person that's ahead of them in order to gain that power, their right to leadership. So Nadav and Avihu don't do it in that manner, but still are thinking in a manner which says we want to be the leaders and we can't wait for those in front of us to pass away. Let's see who buries whom. Amar Rav Papa, Anu Damre Inche, that's what people say. It's a common expression. Nefishe gamle save. There are many older camels that are carrying the skins of younger camels. As Rashi notes, the word bichrei in Yeshayahu, which refers to camels, is translated in the Targum as being hugnei, and that's what the word over here hugnei means. And then he brings from Yirmiyahu that a bichrei kala is a young camel that has yet to carry a burden. So the older camels that are doing the work, the younger camels are out thinking, like, when do we get the job? When do we get the opportunity? Meantime, the older camels stay around for a long time, and then they're carrying, in the end, the skins of the younger camels who either were killed or died before them. And that leadership doesn't always pass so quickly, and we find that many times, that people who are in positions of leadership end up living for a very long time. And that by the time the next generation gets the opportunity to be in the position of leadership, they're already older, or they have to wait a significant amount of time before they can get there. And the individuals have to be patient, number one. And number two is not be driven by power or driven by the jealousy and the desire for power and leadership that drive them to maybe want to get rid of or hope to get rid of those that are in front of them. So that's what is here, that Nadav and Abihu make that mistake or sin in that way. And maybe that's connected to Chotim ben Afshutam that we saw before, that because the Kinah v'Ta'ava ate them up or caused them to act in this manner. So that's why Maharsha connects it not only to the story of Nadav and Abihu before, but also to the Adat Korach, and says that here the Gemara is trying to indicate that maybe Nadav and Abihu's punishment, where they were burnt internally and not externally, is similar because of this Nida Keneged Midah, which is Chotim ben Afshutam, that they're sinning with their Nafshot, and that is what causes them to be killed ben Afshutam. And so their sin wasn't that they knocked off Moshe and Aaron, their sin was that they thought in that manner, or they had thoughts in that direction. And those were improper thoughts or improper way to deal with the ascension to leadership or the desire for leadership. The real good leaders are people who don't want to be in the limelight. People who don't want to be leaders, they turn out to be the best leaders because they don't have personal interest. It's not for their personal desire or power that they want to be there. They are there reluctantly because the Sibur needs them in service. On the other hand, those that are desiring it, those that are trying to get there to ascend to that power, that's been driven by kina, tava, kavod, all of these negative traits, which in the end make them poor leaders. And that's what happens here, that the Nadav and Abihu in the end are killed off because of that. As Rashi notes over here, Aidi de Ayyid bin Aaron, Tanale Hocha Lashminun, de Bishvil Shayyum and Bakshim, Srarab Rabbanot, Meitu, comes to teach us that the reason they died is because they were looking for power and leadership. And that's what precipitated their death. But the truth is that that's not why they die, or that's not why they're killed. They're killed because they bring an ish zara in the Mikdash. So many of the Rishonim discuss how either there was a duality of reasons over here that why they're killed. This was part of the reason that they either brought the ish zara because they were so haughty and thought of themselves as leaders. Therefore, they didn't take precaution and brought the ish zara into the Mikdash. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that their haughtiness or their actions over here lost them the possible protection that they would have had when they went into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, because this took away what otherwise would have given them protection because of the way that they acted, or the fact that they acted in this way made them liable. And that liability was only taken later on when they did something wrong. They're not going to be punished just because they're standing there, but once they entered a place of sakana, then already Hashem took advantage of that to take retribution for what they're doing here. Amar Rabbi Elazar, b'ma tamid chacham domeh lifnei amaretz. How is a tamid chacham treated or viewed by an amaretz? Bitchila, in the beginning, when the tamid chacham is simply an individual full of Torah, wisdom, and good teachings, and someone who is a holy person, Domeh the Keton Shel Zahav. Looks like a golden goblet or pitcher, meaning that he respects him and looks up to him. Siper Emenu, Domeh the Keton Shel Kesef. If he already uses the Amaretz for services of speaking with him in secular matters, then that diminishes the Talmud Chacham in the eyes of the Amaretz. Nehenemi Menu, he gets hanah from him, he take advantage or money from them, then he starts to look like a pitcher or a goblet made out of clay or earthenware. And once it's broken, there's no way to put it back together. And so what's being described here is the deterioration of the standing or stature of the Talmud Chacham in the eyes of the Amaretz, depending on how independent they are. The more independent that the Rav is, the more independent that the Talmud Chacham is, the more respect that is garnered from the Amaretz, because he looks up to the Talmud Chacham's tremendous wisdom, his being involved in Torah, and he respects that. On the other hand, once the Talmud Chacham diminishes himself by bringing the Amaretz or using the Amaretz for services or takes money from him, then already the Amaretz gains a certain stature and says, the only reason he's able to do that is because of me. Whether it's because of the service that he provides, or it's because of the money that he gives him, I'm the facilitator of what he has. If I'm the facilitator of what he has, then There's no reason for me to respect him. He should be respecting me. I'm the one providing him everything that he has. That's what Rashi sees as a connection to the previous Gemara about Adat Korach, that the fact that they took benefit from Korach, then they were easily swayed, or the fact that they were caught up in Chanifa caused the whole problem. And similarly over here, a Talmid Chacham that engages in Chanifa, in the end, they will lose all respect for him. On the other hand, the Meiri sees it more closely connected to Nadav and Avihu, which is the Gemara here says that looks negatively upon the search for leadership or separation from the people. Nevertheless, it's still encouraging that there should be at least some separation and don't then become a part of the Homon Am, because there are problems then in degrading or diminishing the respect for Torah. And obviously this has major impact in the way that issues are conducted in Eretz Yisrael today, where people who feel that they are funding the world of Torah, people have no association with Torah and have no connection to any of this and don't even think that it's helpful, but because the way that the budgets are done in Eretz Yisrael, the country or the government funds these items, the Ami Aretz say, we're the ones funding it. We're the ones who provide the Torah. In that way, it diminishes their respect for those individuals. And they feel in the end that why should we have to give them the money, or why should they have to do this, or why do they have the right to do this? That causes friction between them because of that lack of independence. Again, it's obviously very difficult because in the end, the Talmidei Chachamim have to find a way to support themselves and to provide for themselves. So he has to be careful about that balance, providing for oneself, but not doing it in a way that diminishes the stature of Torah. Imrata Batali. So this is the name of an individual, a woman, Bat Kohen Shezinta Havai. She was a Bat Kohen who engaged in Znot, and therefore was subject to the punishment of Srefa. Akfa Rav Chama Bar Tuvia Chavilei Zmurot. So Rav Chama Bar Tuvia surrounded her with bundles of kindling, Visarfa, and burnt her at the stake. And Rav Yosef Ta'al Batarte. He made a mistake about two issues here. Ta'al B'Rav Matna. First of all, you made a mistake about what Rav Matna told us before, which is the way that you are burnt is a ptila shelavar. It's using lead or molten lead as the punishment, not burning at the stake. V'tab in Netanya. You also made a mistake in the Braita. Ubat elakohanim alevim velashofet eshiyah b'imayim mahim. It says you will come up to the kohanim, the levim, and the shofet that will be in that day. V'zman sheyesh kohen, yesh mishpat. When there is a Kohen, then there is Mishpat. Bizman Jain Kohen, ain't Mishpat. If there is no Kohen, then there is no Mishpat. The way that Rashi explains it is, She'ein Beitim Emitim Elzman Lishkat HaGazit. It's only a case where Beitim gives death penalties, capital punishment, when there is a Lishkat HaGazit, means that the Sanhedrin is sitting in the area by the Mikdash. Ba'osha Sanhedrin no Geget, but Lishkat HaGazit. When they sit in Lishkat HaGazit, no Geget af b'chutz laretz. Then it applies even in the Chutz Laretz, or in general, capital punishment can only be executed when the Sanhedrin is in its proper place by the Makom that they are supposed to be in, and Tosafot already raises that issue. Why doesn't the Gemara just bring that we said earlier in the Masechta, as well as what we're going to see further on in Masechta, the Malameich and Makom Gorein, that the place is what causes the ability to bring capital punishment. Tosafot leaves it as a Tzarchion as to why the Gemara doesn't bring that Pasuk down. But basically, Rav Chama Bar Tuvia didn't have a right to execute capital punishment because of the fact that there was no Beit HaMikdash in his time. He's clearly of the later Amoraim, and yet he was still doing this, even though the Beit HaMikdash was not extant. Others suggest, and you can see this in the Rabbeinu Chananel, Bizman Sheish Kohen Misharet Lifnei Hashem, Yesh Mishpat, that when the Kohen is in service in the Mikdash, then you have mishpat. Then capital punishment can be executed. So it's not about the Sanhedrin sitting in the Lishkat HaGazit. It's the fact that the Kohen is serving in the Mikdash, which also might result in there being a Sanhedrin in Lishkat HaGazit. But here he connects it more directly to the Kohen's service. That may be the reason why they don't bring the Pasuk that Tosafot is suggesting. In general, it's very strange what Rav Chama did over here, because it's our Mishnah. Our Mishnah is explicit about the fact that you use a ptilah to kill him. You don't burn him at the stake. Only Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok mentions the other possibility. So you could argue that he held like Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok. That's one possibility. Or more likely is he didn't know what the meaning of ptila was. He didn't know what that meant, ptila. He thought ptila wick just meant that you light with the wick and you set the whole thing on fire. Not a ptila shalavar. So he didn't know Rav Matna's explanation of what was to be done here or how to do it over here. Or the other possibility is that he was using extrajudicial powers. This is something that we saw before, that Beit Din is makim ba'onshin shelo min hadin. That Beit Din have a right to take matters into their own hands and punish in a severe way, that's whether capital or corporal punishment, in order to bring law and order back, or to ensure that people are keeping the laws of the Torah. And that might be what Rav Chama Bar Tuvia was doing over here, because he was trying to bring back Seder. There was promiscuity, there was a problem of tzniut, and he needed to send a message clearly that that was wrong. Now he didn't want to punish when one of the Arba Mitot Beit Din, because that would have looked like he was actually executing based on the Torah law, or prescription in this case. So therefore he did a modified mitah in order that it would be clear that it was being done by the Beit Din as a preventative or a way to reestablish the proper behavior in society. So they took this action, even though it wasn't the Sreifah of the Torah. And the reason that they still think that he was wrong about this, or mistaken, was that it was a singular case. A bat kohen shezinta is a less likely or more unlikely situation, and given that, it was not right for him to take this type of severe action, or give capital punishment in order to make an example out of this woman, when this wasn't a problem that was far-reaching in society, or a common occurrence in society. So that's why you have to balance between the mistake of Rav Chama Bar Tuvia. The more you say that it was a bigger mistake or obvious mistake, the less understandable it is why he did this or how did he not know this. The more justified he is in what he did, then it's hard to understand why they were criticizing him for it. So you have to find a balance between why he made the mistake or what he was doing and what was wrong with that. So this is a way to do it by saying it was an extrajudicial action taken in order to bring back law and order. And the criticism of the Gemara is that it wasn't necessary, it was an unusual event, it wasn't something that was so common. We have a similar idea by Shimon Shetach, but over there, it seems that that was something that was plaguing the people, or was of epidemic proportions, that they were having this problem with Kishuf. Over here, it seems to be it was a singular and isolated incident, and therefore it didn't justify doing something like this in this instance. And again, he might have followed the position of Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Tzadok in the Mishnah, which we don't paskin like in the end. So he might have found grounds for it, or why they don't bring the Mishnah as a question on him, is because of that. And even though, as the Baalei Tosafot note over here, that Tal b'Rav Matna is ba'af Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok nami chazar bo. That even Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok backed away from this position eventually, and that's why it's a mistake that he might have followed that position or thought that that was a valid position in the Mishnah. All right. Amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok, ma'aseh b'bat kohen shezinta. Amar Rabbi Yosei, beit din shel tzukim haba. This is what we mentioned before, that the reason the Chachamim say you can't bring evidence from what you're saying is because they were a Beit Din Shel Tzukim. They took Tzukim literally. They didn't darshan the Tzukim. They didn't have the Gzeirot Shavuot. They just took the puzzle literally and gave Sreifa. So, Hachi Amar Lahu, this is what he said to them. Hachi Hadrule. And this is how they answered him. He brought the example, and then they answered him that it was a Beit Din Shel Tzukim. Vatanya. Does that really work? Is that really the way to understand the Mishnah? We have the Tosefta that says, Amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok, Zachorni k'shaiti tinok. I remember when I was a youngster, umurkav al ktefo shel abba, and I was riding on my father's shoulders, ve'viu bat kohen shezinta. They brought a bat kohen who was mizana, ve'kifua chavile zmurot. They covered her in kindling, in firewood, ve'sarfua, and they burnt her at the stake for having an adulterous affair. So I'm lo, katana ita. They said, doesn't matter, you were a youngster at the time, and therefore you can't bring evidence from that. Because you don't bring evidence from someone who was a youngster. The truth is that he's not really bringing any evidence, he's just telling of an incident that took place. So he's not bringing testimony or evidence, he's just showing you that this did take place. So you have to answer that. The point is, if you're a katan, you don't have the discerning ability to understand what type of Beit Din was doing this. So, you might have seen it, and you might have seen a Beit Din doing it, but you didn't know the quality of that Beit Din, or you didn't know what type of Beit Din that was. So we're not denying that you saw it, we're just saying that it may not be a proof because we don't know the quality of that Beit Din. When I said Shnei Masim Havu, in Ochanami, there were two incidents, meaning that Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Tzadok brings two statements of proof to the Chachamim. One of which is, when I was a youngster, I saw this. And another one is that he gives evidence or testimony to the fact that a Beit Din did this. Hey, Amar Lahu Bereisha. Which of these two proofs did he bring first? Ilim Hakamaita Amar Lahu Bereisha. If the one in our Mishnah is what he stated first, Amar Lahu Kishuk Gadol, Vloashkuhu Beit. When he was an adult, he gives evidence or says something about it, and they didn't listen to him. Amar Lahu Kishuk Katan, Vashkuhu Beit. Then he's going to say, oh yeah, I also saw it when I was a youngster. What does that do? If he, when he's a gadol, he says that I saw or I heard about this Beit Din that did this, then why would he then back that up with saying that, oh, when I was younger, I also saw this. The fact that they already rejected it when he's a gadol is enough reason to say that they don't buy into what he's saying. Adding on top of that, he saw when he was a katan is not relevant. Elaham arlohu bereisha. So he has to be that he's saying the one over here, meaning the one about the katan is what he said about first. Vamrulei katan hayita. So first he gives evidence, he says, when I was a youngster riding my father's shoulders, I saw a Beit Din burn a woman at the stake for being mizana, for an adulterous affair when she was a bat kohen. And then they respond to him and say, you were a youngster, you can't bring any proof from that. Then he said a second time, I saw it not only when I was a katan, but even as a gadol, I also saw something similar again. The reason that we can't take that as evidence is because the Beit Din I was executing in this case wasn't necessarily an expert Beit Din. It wasn't necessarily a Beit Din of Prushim. They were a Beit Din of Stukim. So he presents the case twice. He presents the case first as I saw a woman burnt at the stake when I was a youngster. Say, when you're a youngster, there's no proof. And again, not necessarily because he's bringing evidence or he's testifying, but because he's not discerning it enough to know what he saw when he was a youngster. He might have seen her being burnt at the stake, but he doesn't know all the background and the surrounding facts. So he says, all right, fine. I also saw a woman being burnt at the stake when I was older. There they rejected his evidence because they say it was a mistaken Beit Din. It was a Beit Din didn't know what they were doing. Therefore, you can't bring proof from it. And that's the order in which he brought the proofs, which makes it logical that he would ask from a katan and then ask when he himself had seen it or witnessed it. And the Chachamim in each case have a response which says that it's not a proof. Mitzvat ha-ne'eragim. The mitzvah of those that are killed by the sword. Hayumetizim et roshob b'sayif. They decapitate him. They take off his head by the sword. K'derech shamachut oseh. Just like the government does. The same way that the government executes, that's the way you would do it. Yodomer nivul hu lo. That is something that is beneath his dignity. It's denigrating. Now the question is, why is it nivul? Rashi claims over here that it's nivul hu lo because he's standing up. And then when you behead him or decapitate him, he falls down and the body just goes all over the place. So that's what's not becoming about such a mitah. The others, Tosafot and the Yad Ramaz, follow the Gemara and say that the nivul he'll hear is the fact that the Malchut does it. The fact that the government or the non-Jewish nations do that, then that's why it's a nivul, because now you're copying this executions that they do and then you're executing them in the same manner. So that's a nivul over here. Ella, menichim et rosho al hasdan. You put his head down on the chopping block, v'kotzeitz bekupitz, and then you chop it off with a hatchet. Amulo emitam nuvelet mizo. There is nothing more degrading than a killing like that. So that's for a number of reasons. First of all, it's done on the chopping block. Number two, it's done with a kupitz, a hatchet. And number three is that's the way that you deal with meat and behemot. So for all three of those items, it's improper or beneath the dignity of the individual to be killed in that manner. So even though it might be a nivul, what we're saying, what you're offering as the alternative, is even a bigger nivul. Tanya, Amarlein Rabbi Yehuda l'chachamim, afani yodeh shemitah minuvelati. I agree with you. What I'm suggesting is not better. What I'm suggesting is degrading or much worse than what you are suggesting. Of amaya seh, I'm compelled to say that, shrei amra Torah ubichukoteyem lo teilechu. You may not follow the ways of the goyim. Since the sword is mentioned in the Torah, we're not copying them. We're not doing it because they do it. We're doing it because the Torah dictates that we do it. So if you don't say that, hadatanya sofim ala milachim, that we allow there to be a pyre after the death of the king where they burn all the possessions of the king. And we suggest over there that that's not copying the practice of the non-Jews. Hechi Sarfinan. How can we burn it if they do this now? It'd be a copying a practice of the non-Jews. You're not allowed to mimic their ways or follow in their ways. But since the Torah already mentions this practice, this Jewish practice earlier, because it says by umemisrifot avotecha, and the truth is that in the pasuk it's a chaf and not a bet, it's umechimisrifot avotecha, that you will die a normal death, and you will be treated like the kings that came before you, which is that they burn all their possessions at the pyre. They will do for you the pomp and circumstance and the proper ceremony that is befitting a king, but that will not be true of your descendants who will be taken into galut and conquered by others. So here you see that there was this practice. Just interesting note that the Gemara says it's written in the Torah and then brings you a pasuk from Navi. But what it's showing you is that this practice is a Jewish practice. And therefore, lo minayu kangabrinan, we're not learning to do this from them. So too in our case, since the sword is mentioned in the Torah as the means by which to execute an individual, lo minayu kangabrinan, we didn't learn this practice from them. In essence, they copied us. Who says that we copied them? Tosfot over here asks from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, and this has major implications in the halacha. Over here, our Gemara seems to indicate that it would be sufficient if there is a pasuk in the Torah that tells us that this practice was done beforehand. That is enough to tell us or to teach us that it's not subject to b'chukutei and lo teilechu. It's not considered darchei amori. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah, on the other hand, brings two qualifications. It says, first of all, you need a pasuk. And number two is that it cannot be a practice l'Avodah Zarah. Cannot be something that they do specifically for Avodah Zarah. So now, Tosfot says, how do I reconcile between what seemingly is a stira between the sugya here in Sanhedrin and the sugya in Avodah Zarah? So Tosfot over here says, V'yesh lamar, tahotam kamar lav chukahi l'shem avodat kochavim. Diyami chukah l'avodat kochavim. In Avodah Zarah, when it says it's not a practice of Avodah Zarah, it's because if it was a practice of Avodah Zarah, then afkilu avakatu be'oraita. Even if there was a pasuk written, lo havi mahane, it would not help at all. Of a halcha aire, over here it seems to be dealing with b'choko v'dokhim shalol shem avodat kochavim. The practice that they're mentioning over here is something that clearly has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. The fact that the malchut kills people by beheading them has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah whatsoever. In that case, it's sufficient to find a precedent in the Torah. So the Baal HaYom Tosafot solved the problem by saying that the Gemaras are speaking about different cases. Gemara in Avodah Zarah is speaking about a practice that possibly could be Avodah Zarah. So as long as the practice is not Avodah Zarah, then I can invoke the Pasuk to help me. In a case where it's clearly not done for Avodah Zarah, then you just need a Pasuk. So our case here in Sanhedrin, where it's clear that beheading is practiced by the government, but it's not a worship of Avodah Zarah, the Pasuk is sufficient. In Avodah Zarah, where they're speaking about the burning of the king's possessions, over there it's not clear whether there is a Avodah Zarah reason behind the practice. So first we have to establish that it's not an Avodah Zarah reason, meaning that they do it for the honor of the king. And then secondarily, we have to say that even though it's a practice of theirs, it's not a problem because you have a pasuk that backs up the fact that we do it. But for the Baal HaYom Tosafot, if it's a practice of the Avodah Zarah, then that would automatically preclude it, irrespective of whether you have a pasuk or not. See that with regards to the matzevot, that the avot used the matzevot as means to bring korbanot to Hashem, but later on Hashem says that you only can bring korbanot on mizbechot and not matzevot. The reason being is that that was a practice that was picked up by the Ovdei Kochavim. And so the Ovdei Kochavim made it something that was devar sanuei l'Hashem, even though there was already precedence in the Avot to do such a thing. So you see, something can change status, even though its precedence is in the Torah, or it was an earlier practice of the Jews. And that, in essence, is the proof of the Baal HaYom Tosafot, that when you have an Avodah Zarah practice that's picked up, even though it has precedence in the Torah, you cannot justify using it anymore, and it's subject to B'chukuteim lo teilechu. On the other hand, if you have practices that are unknown, we'll assume that they are Avodah Zarah practices unless we can find precedents in the Torah. And so therefore the Tosfot always look for precedents in the Torah and the Navi in order to justify a practice. And the Gron Shulchan Aruch seems to back this view of the Balei HaTosafot in dealing with these issues. On the other hand, the Ran believes that there are two categories of Hukudei Motelecho. There's one category which is those that are done for Avodah Zarah. Those are clearly problematic. There's another category of items which are unknown. And again, there, we will assume, like the Balei HaTosafot say, that they are Avodah Zarah practices. But the Ran says, if we can find justification for the practice, then if it's not obviously associated with the Avodah Zarah, the fact that there's a reason for that practice is enough of a reason to say that it is mutar, not classified as uchukutem lo telechu. And you wouldn't necessarily need a pasuk min haTorah. You simply fact that it's a justified practice is enough of a reason to deem it not to be uchukutem lo telechu. The Ma'arik in a tshuva then adds in that he thinks that anything that is a practice without a reason, irrespective if it's connected to Avodah Zarah or not, that is called B'Kudem L'Telechu, because that is exactly what it is. It's a chok. It is a practice that has no reason, and even though it might be culturally accepted, it might be fashionable, but since it has no reason behind it, therefore, it's called a chok, and you may not emulate it, because if you emulate it, in a sense, you're looking up to their culture, you're looking up to the way that they live, and that is subject to the restriction of Hukudeim lo telechu, which is even a greater chumrah now, because he does not associate any of this with Avodah Zarah. He simply associates it with Hukudeim lo telechu, as opposed to the Ran and the Balei HaTosafot, who say that there is this assumption of Avodah Zarah, and if you can shed that, then you're okay. Over here, the Ma'arik seems to indicate that, irrespective of whether it's connected to Avodah Zarah, if it has no reasoning behind it, then it's classified as Hukudeim lo telechu, which is a big chumrah, but it's a chumrah mevevi de kula, because then it opens up the possibility, if you can find a reason for a practice, that would be matir, that practice, because it's no longer covered by Hukudeim lo telechu. Meaning that if there is some reason other than emulating the non-Jews that someone would pick up this practice or make sense out of this practice, then it would be justified and not subject to B'chukudeim lo telechu. And in his tshuva, he discusses the issue of professionals wearing certain types of clothing. Or the Ma'arik, who says that there was a practice in his time to where the doctors used to wear cloaks, and whether if a Jewish doctor wore the cloak, was that considered to be a uchukutem lo telechu? His answer was no, because they don't wear the cloak for no reason. They wear the cloak to identify this individual as a practicing doctor, because it's a form of advertising, as well as it is a form of indication that this person is a professional. And so wearing the beged is not a problem of uchukutem lo telechu, but rather a practice that has reason behind it. And that reason is sufficient to say that it's not a practice of Avodah Zarah and does not require a precedence in the Torah. Although he does qualify that by saying that if the Chachamim or the leadership in any generation or community believes that a practice of the Goyim, even though it has a reason behind it, is against the spirit of the Torah, whether it means it's against the Tzniut, against the Midot, against the Hashkafah, the Torah, then they can prohibit it or tell us that it's subsumed under B'chukudeim lo telechu because that practice is negative for Jewish values. So even though it has a reason, it's against the value system of the Torah, and that's also subject to B'chukudeim lo telechu. That tshuva ends up having major impact in the follow-on in terms of how the poskim deal with the B'chukudeim lo telechu. That leads to major implications in terms of how we apply B'chukudeim lo telechu. When we have practices that are similar to the non-Jews, are those practices subject to B'chukudeim lo telechu? Does the Torah already give us precedence? Does the Torah already tell us something like this happened? Is this a practice of Avodah Zarah, or is this a practice with reason behind it? All those factors will be important in determining whether it is considered to be a practice of B'chukudeim lo telechu, and whether certain things that we do today are considered to be emulating the non-Jews or something that is a Jewish practice or not subject to B'chukudeim lo telechu. and has impact on things like Thanksgiving, the eating of turkey on Thanksgiving, items like wearing certain bigadim, certain cloaks or clothing that is done by professionals. So now the Gemara wants to understand, where is it written that there's cherev or that you're killed by the sword? So he says, that which we have in the upcoming perek, these are the people that are subject to a death penalty by beheading. Harutzeach, someone who kills. And those in a city that the robe of the city worships Avodah Zarah by the influence of others in Ir Nidachat. Bishlama Ir Nidachat Tibu. But Ir Nidachat is explicit. And it says that the punishment is by cherev because it says, Lefi cherev, by the sword. Ella Rutzeach Minolan. How do you know Rutzeach is killed Behereg? Titania Nakom Yinakim. That it says the person who commits murder and kills an Eved Knani, that Nakom Yinakim, that you will take revenge upon him or meet out revenge on him. Nikima zu en yodea mahu. When it says Nakom Yinakim, I don't know what that means. What's the definition of that punishment? Shomer Vebeti Alechem Cherev Nokemet Nikambrit, when the Torah already specifies in the Tochacha, that when it says that I will bring the sword, that is no kemet, that brings revenge. So you see that there is a parallel or connection between the word nikama and the cherev. And just like in the Tochacha, the cherev is what brings about the nikama, so too over here that the Nogamina came, the instruction that must take revenge on this individual is similarly done by the sword. And from here you learn that the nekama is associated with the sword. Why do you think that he has to be decapitated? Why don't you say that we pierce him and stab him with the sword? It doesn't say here that you have to cut him with the sword, so you could stab him with the sword. It says, it says, by the sword. Now, what does that indicate? The pi cherev, by the mouth of the sword. And as Rashi notes over here that a double-edged sword has a sharp end on both sides. It has two edges to the sword. And then you have the point of the sword. So the pi acherev means the edge of the sword. So you have to use one of the edges of the sword to kill, and not by piercing, which is not the edge of the sword, but rather the top of the sword. And so therefore, pi cherev tells you to use the edge of the sword to kill, and that would be done by decapitating, not by piercing or stabbing. Rashi explains that a sword naturally has two edges, there are two PPO to it. If you stab the individual, then both edges of the sword, when they come to a point, will be affecting the individual. Then if you decapitate the individual, it'll be pi cherev. It'll be only one edge of the sword. Others explain, like we said before, that it's the pi and not the top of the sword. The pi means the edge or the side of the sword, not the point of the sword. Ve'ema davidele gistera. How do you know that when you have to cut him by the mouth of the edge of the sword, it means to decapitate him? Maybe it means to cut him in half, split him in half. Gistera means to sever completely. It means to cut in half. When you slice an animal in half, that's called a gistera. Same thing with a human being. If you completely slice them in half. Rashi says here it's vertically. You're cutting them top to bottom, but it's possible you can create a gistera by going across and dividing the body in half completely. So Parasuk says, Amar Krabba, Aftal Recha Kamocha, Bror Lo Mita Yafa. So again, we invoke the principle of Aftal Recha Kamocha, the decapitation is a much more humane and less painful way to kill the individual rather than splitting them in half. Ashkan de Katal Abda. So the pasuk that you brought, that cherev is used as the punishment for someone who is a murderer, that's only true by a case of an Eved Kenani, because that's where the pasuk is written in Parshat Mishpatim. Bar Chorim Minalan. How do you know if he kills not a Eved Kenani, but he kills a regular Ben Chorin? How do we know? V'lav Kal V'chomer. Isn't it a Kal V'chomer? Isn't it a logical extension? Kotel Abda B'sayif. If he kills an Eved Kenani, he's subject to death penalty by Hereg, Bar Chorim Bechenek, then a person who is a free individual, who is a regular Yisrael, you're going to say that the death penalty for murdering them is Chenek? That doesn't make sense, because Chenek is the generic death penalty that's given. And if you give him the generic death penalty of Chenek, then it would be downgrading him. It's saying that you get a lighter form of punishment for killing someone who has more standing in society. So when it says, Anichel Amandamar Chenek Kal, that makes sense according to one who says that chenek is the lighter form of punishment. So that logic stands if you say that chenek is a lower form of punishment. And in that way, it makes it clear that downgrading them to a punishment of chenek doesn't make any sense. Therefore, if you give cheref for saif for the Eved Kanani, then certainly you would do it for a ben chorin. According to the one, meaning Rabbi Shimon, who says that chenek is more chamor than herek, how does he know? Ma'ika the Meimar. What can you say there? Nafkalei mi detani. You'll learn it out from this following braita. That you have to wipe out all of the innocent blood from amongst you. That now that pasuk that's written by the Egla Ufa connects it to murderers. Malalan b'sayif uminat zavar. Just like over there by Egla Ufa, it requires a sword and from the neck. Afkan b'sayif uminat zavar. So to over here, it'll be by the sword and at the neck. Imal alan b'kupitz umimul orif. Wait a minute, it's not exactly the same. By Egla Rufa, the requirement number one is to do Mula Oref. So now you have to, Oref is the back of the face. That which is opposite the face on the head is called the Oref. Mula Oref is something that is opposing the Oref or something that sees the Oref. So what sees the back of the head is the neck. And that's why you know that Mula Oref means to kill or to do something to the back of the neck. So now the Gemara is saying, by Egla Rufa, there's a requirement to do it mul oref, number one. And number two is to use a kupitz, to use a hatchet. So if you're comparing murderers to Egla Arufa, that would indicate that the mechanism that should be used is back of the neck and a kupitz. But that's not what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says, b'sayif. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Ravu, Amar Krav, Aftal Recha Kamocha, Bror Lo Mita Yafa. Over here we invoke the principle again of Aftal Recha Kamocha, which is, if you have a choice, Kamashia by using a sword and beheading the individual, or using a hatchet and killing them from the back of the neck, then it seems that doing it through the sword would be the nicer, more humane, less painful way to do it. And therefore we would opt for that explanation versus saying that Egla Rufa dictates that it be done by a kupitz and mul ha'orif. Mitzvah danecha nakim. So now we're up to the last of the four possible mitot beitin, and that is choking. Again, they bury him up to his knees in this dung or the garbage. And this is where the Yad Ramah brings his proof to the fact that he thinks that burying him up to his arkutavav bezevel is not to stop him from moving around, rather the problem of him losing his control over his bodily functions, because here you do it in a situation where it's less of an issue. Rashi says on the Sreifa, it's got to do with us getting him to be steady so we can pour the molten lead down his throat. Over here, you don't have that issue, so why would you have to bury him up to Arkavotav Bezevel? But as we mentioned before, you could argue that just we don't want the person moving around. If you want an expeditious death, as well as the person not causing problems or fighting back, the best way to do that is to incapacitate the individual so that they can't stop the death penalty from being carried out. Although the Lech HaMishnah does suggest that the whole idea of burying him into the Zevel up to his knees was a bizoy, or denigration of the individual, and has nothing to do with the practical sides of the execution being done. And once the Rabbanan instituted it by Sreifa, they also put it in place by Chenek, because those are the two areas where it would be relevant to do such a denigration. Notein sudar kasheh l'toch harakan, you put the harder, more sturdy handkerchief in the softer one, and then you wrap it around his neck. Each one of the Edim pulls to each side. Until the person is strangulated, until they die from that. In all these cases, we put the harsher or stronger handkerchief or cloth inside of a softer one so that the softer one protects the neck of the individual, doesn't cause any damage or menavel the individual. And you need the stronger cloth or handkerchief so that it doesn't tear when you're pulling out force on both sides to strangulate. So that's both here and what we saw previously. It seems like from this Mishnah and the Mishnah by Sreifa, that Shnaim, that there are two involved, and it sounds like it's the Edim that are involved. But the case of Saif, it never specifies who does it, but we would assume that the Edim should be involved with it because of all the reasons we spoke about by Skila. That's why we want the Edim involved. Both because we want the people who witness the event directly and have the most certainty about it to execute, as well as the fact that what I mentioned, that we want the Edim to know that they're not just testifying in a vacuum, that their testimony obligates them then to execute this individual, and they're the ones going to have to do it. So don't think that you're just testifying falsely and no big deal and you walk out and somebody else could execute him, you're going to be the ones who kill. And it's not just lying under oath. It's not just false testimony. It's going to be literally that you're going to kill the individual based on your testimony. So all of those would argue in favor of saying that the Edim are the ones who perform the execution in each of these instances. Tarabanan. So now the Gemara brings down a pasuk. Ish asher yinaf et eshet re'ehu. Person who engages in adultery with his friend's wife. And we know that the punishment for adultery is chenek. We already did that. That's the stam mita in the Torah. That is the mita that is applicable by niuf. Now the Gemara dashes. Ish prat lekatan. So an ish has to be someone who is of age. It's coming to exclude a katan. Now this exclusion of the katan is extremely controversial, and all the Yishonim try to deal with it, which is, what's the havamina that the katan is going to be chayav over here? A katan is not brought to trial. A katan is not subject to the death penalty. The katan is below the age at which he can be held criminally liable. And so if that's the case, why do you have to come and tell me in the pasuk that only an ish and not a katan? The answers to that question are varied. Some suggest that it's a katan over the age of 9, where his bi'ah is classified as a bi'ah, and that's what it means, prat the katan, even though his bi'ah will cause the woman to be put to death, it will not allow him to be put to death. Others suggest that maybe we would prosecute him now as a katan, but defer the punishment until he was older, and so that's what the Torah comes to say, if the action was taken when he is a katan, he's not criminally liable for that, even when he grows up. Or, you have to say, since the woman is being punished, maybe the child should also be put to death. Or you can compare it to the case of behema. In a case where there's bestiality performed, even though the animal is innocent in the case, we still kill the animal because of the clone, the embarrassment, and the nature of the relationship. So maybe you could argue over here as well, that even though the child is quote-unquote an innocent victim over here, nevertheless, he should be put to death because of the same way that we put a behemoth to death in cases of bestiality. So the Rishonim, in those different manners, tried to deal with the problem of why the Gemara here has to exclude a katan. Asher yinafet eshet ish, prat le eshet katan, that he had an adulterous affair with someone who was a woman who was married to a man, not a woman who is married to a katan, because a katan cannot establish kiddushin. If that's the case, again, there's a question, why does the Torah have to come and preclude him? There is no kiddushin for a katan. So the answer might be that there are two instances where a katan can, midoraita, generate kiddushin or generate a marriage. One is the case of yibum. As long as he's over the age by which his bi'ah is considered to be a bi'ah, we know that yibum is consummated and the kiddushin and nisuin all happen simultaneously with bi'ah. And so in a Torah, maybe the katan can acquire his wife through yibum, which means that the kiddushin was generated by a gadol, his brother, and then now he is marrying that wife through bi'ah, which he can do, and maybe that can generate the kiddushin, or through the parshia of Ye'ud, which is mentioned in the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim with regards to an ama ivriyah, that the owner of the Amaria has a number of choices as to what to do with her. One is to marry her, or to marry her off to his child, or to allow her to redeem herself and to go free. So now, in those options, one of them is Ye'ud, designating the Amaria for his son. So there is a way for a child or a katan to be married midoraita if the father designates this woman to be the wife of that child. Eshet re'ehu, the wife of your friend, prat le eshet acherim. That comes to exclude the wives of non-Jews. So now, that's interesting. And here, Tosfot says, v'hainu kutim. That's a woman of kutim. V'kamashman, v'eini shut the kutim. That there is no marriage. There is no such thing as ishut with regards to the non-Jews. So that's why yesterday I spoke about the problem that we have with the four psulim, as one of them is an Obed Kochavim. How could that be the problem if there is no marriage, there's no ishut for a goy? And that's why I raised the issue, and I told you that the Yad Ramah and others suggest that the Girsa was not Obed Kochavim, but rather a Kuti, and that is that there is a restriction against marrying them, even though they might have a status as Jews in some way or some form. So he says that's the idea that the Kuti has the ability to generate Kiddushin, but still be restricted because the Torah might not look favorably upon that type of marriage. But here Tosfot adds on something else. V'avagav de'ein mitav azara. So even though there's no death penalty, isura mi'aika. Says clearly there's a problem with doing this. Committing adultery with a woman who's married to a non-Jew, whether it's a Jewish woman or a non-Jewish woman, over there, even though it's not subject to the death penalty or the restriction that's mentioned here, nevertheless, Tosfot says there has to be an isur. There's something wrong with it. V'idish mishrei yifat toar. The fact that the Torah has to specify that a fatwa is permitted, even though she's a married woman, means that the Torah thinks otherwise it's not permitted. So what does that mean, otherwise it's not permitted? You could argue that's from the tzad of marriage, but the way that Tosfot explains it is it's from the tzad of the isur involved. But there is an isur over here to engage in an affair with a married woman, even though that marriage doesn't have a status of the Torah in terms of the death penalty. Nevertheless, it has enough status in terms of isur that we would consider it to be inappropriate and something that is a violation of a precept of the Torah, even though it may not be punishable by death. Mojumat, they will be put to death, bechenek. That will be through strangulation. Atomer bechenek, or ino elo beachat mikomitotum rot b'Torah. How do you know that bechenek is the right punishment over here, not the other death penalties in the Torah? Amar komakom shnemar mita b'Torah stam inat harashay l'moshcha lachmir ala elala kelala divrei Rabbi Hoshaya. Hoshaya says it's a logical argument, which is we have the requirement to put these people to death. The Torah doesn't specify what death penalty that is. So now I have a choice of the four death penalties that are given to Beit Din. So when I don't know which one to pick and I have a choice, I always go lakula. And the lowest form of death penalty is chenek. So that's why that will be the default over here, that the punishment will be chenek. That's Rabbi Hoshaya's position, and it's logical in that manner. Yonatan Omer, lo mipnei shi kala. It's not because it's the lightest form of punishment. Ela, kol mita marav Torah stam, ena ela chenek. That any time the Torah writes just mita without any explanation, that refers to strangulation. The question is, why? Rabbi Omer, so Rabbi explains it, nemar mita bidei shemayim, and nemar mita bidei adam. Mentions death by the heavens, and mentions death at the hands of man. My mita marav bidei shemayim, mita shem ba roshem. Just like the death that is caused from the heavens, meaning when a person passes away, it doesn't leave a mark on the individual from their passing away. So too, the stam mitah that is mentioned in the Torah is also a mitah that leaves no roshem, and the only one of the three mitot that we have mentioned that has that feature is kanika, is the strangulation, even though that may not necessarily be true. There is some visible damage done when a person is strangled. Nevertheless, that it's done in a way where they put the soft cloth around it, they try to minimize the roshim or markings that are left from that strangulation. Vema sreifa. Why don't we say that it should be punishable by burning? Because if the Torah specifies that a bat kohen gets sreifa, the implications of that are that someone who's not a bat kohen would not get sreifa. So that can't be the option here of stam mita in the Torah. Bishma le Rabbi Yonatan to come and farish Rabbi Tama. Where it says, I understand Rabbi Yonatan's reasoning because Rabbi explains the reason. Just like the death from heaven, when a person passes away, it does not leave a roshim. So to over here, the way that Beit Din should execute this individual, which is to minimize the roshim. Ela Rabbi Hoshaya, mimai dika chenek beolam, a masayif. According to Rabbi Hoshaya, how do you even know that the punishment of chenek is available to you? Never in the Torah is the word or the punishment of chenek mentioned. Sreifa is mentioned, herek by the saif is mentioned, and skila is mentioned, but chenek is never mentioned. So how can you say you go to the lowest form of execution when then that execution itself is not found in the Torah? So the answer is, Amrova Aramito Gemara Gemir Lehu. We have a Mesorah from Moshe Rabbeinu, that there are four executions that are granted to Beit Din. We've already gone through the four mitot Beit Din. And so even though chenek is not explicit in the Torah, it's part of the Mesorah from Moshe Misinai. And therefore, once we have that Mesorah, that those are the four options, then we give the lightest form of punishment. So my lo mipnei shi kala. So what does it mean then when Rabbi Yonatan says the reason that you get the punishment of chenek is not because it's the lightest form of punishment? What do you mean it's not the lightest form of punishment? In the hierarchy of punishments, it is the lightest form of punishment. So how does he say it's not the lightest form of punishment? My answer is,
Rabbi Shai and Rabbi Yonatan are arguing the same machloka that we had between the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon. The Chachamim believe that Chenek is the lowest form of punishment, therefore it becomes the default punishment because it is the lightest form. So that's what Rabbi Shai says. Rabbi Yonatan says, no. That's not the reason. Mita stam in the Torah, it's Chenek, not because it's the lightest form of punishment, because he thinks Hereg, that by the sword is the lightest form of punishment. Chenek is above that. So then why do we give Chenek anytime there's stam mita in the Torah? That's because it emulates the mita of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Just like when a Kodesh Baruch Hu takes someone's life, there's no marking left. So do Chenek is the one mita that doesn't leave any markings on the individual. And even if it does leave some markings, it's the least out of all the four punishments over here in terms of the markings that are left. And therefore, that's why we pick Chenek, not because it's the lightest form. But that means that their positions now also involve the other machloket, where Rabbi Shaya believes like the Chachamim, Chenek is the lightest form of punishment. That's why he thinks it's the Stam Mita. So Rabbi Yonatan, who holds like Rabbi Shimon, says Hereg is the lightest form. That would have been the default. You need a reason why you give Chenek in these cases, and that's because the Mita, we compare it to the Mita of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and that tells us that Chenek is the default Mita in the Torah. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines down on the top of Nun Gimel Amud Aleph.